Disc 6. Chapter 26. The Golden Rule. The Great Path has no gates. Thousands of roads enter it. When you pass through this gateless gate, you walk the universe alone. Mumon. Watching the fire brings back memories of when I was just a regular person. I fondly recall a drinking buddy with whom I used to carry on lofty and semi-coherent philosophical discourse back in my 20s. Obeying Thoreau's precept that the big thoughts require big spaces, we would take our debates outside and shout back and forth across roaring bonfires, busy streets, still ponds, never sitting, never standing still, and never making a whole lot of sense. He was in the process of inventing a version of Christianity that suited his larger-than-life persona, and I was working through Thoreau and Whitman. When we were done with the big thoughts, we'd spin and spin until we'd fall down and cling to the earth until it stopped moving. Why? Haven't a clue. Made sense at the time. Jed? Yes, Mary. What does it mean in Zen Buddhism when they say that to achieve enlightenment, one must pass through the gateless gate? The gate refers to the barrier that stands between the unawakened mind and enlightenment. From the perspective of the person wishing to become enlightened, this gate appears enormous and impassable. It's what you see as the difference between you and me. I tend to think of it more as a series of doors, each of which must be unlocked and passed through before progress can continue. Until finally, the final door is opened, and you look back on your great journey, only to find that you never moved an inch, and that there never was a gate, no doors, no locks, not so much as a line drawn in the sand. Oh, I see. And how is that useful? Good question. I think about it for a moment. I recall my own pre-enlightened thoughts about the gateless gate. I don't believe it is. It's just something you notice once you get past it. Oh, I see. And when they talk about a finger pointing at the moon? Okay. When they talk about a finger pointing at the moon, they're saying you should look where the finger's pointing, not at the finger itself. Don't mistake the finger for the moon. I see. And how is that useful? Well, for instance, if you were to start making a big deal about me, then I would use the finger pointing at the moon thing to get you back on the right track, to put your attention back where it belongs, on the moon, not the finger. Make sense? Yes, thank you. Reading about Zen lately, Mary? Yes, because you talk about it so much. Well, use the opportunity to sharpen your sword of discrimination. Much of what you'll read about Zen is a finger pointing at the finger pointing at the moon rather than at the moon. Keep that in mind, and let me know if you have more questions. Other questions come, and I deal with them. Kundalini, diet, psychedelic drugs, this movie, that book, this guru, that poem, this shortcut, that fad. I'm in a very relaxed state, but eventually the subject of bliss comes up and gets my juices flowing again. I know enlightenment is a state of ecstasy and bliss, begins a newcomer named Jeffrey. Excuse me, I interrupt. I mean, he replies, I know it's about, you know, the experience of bliss, I ask. Ecstasy? Yeah, so what I was wondering... Stop. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. How many of you think that? Show of hands, please. How many of you equate enlightenment with bliss or ecstasy or whatever? Several hands go up. Mary, who was asking about Zen, doesn't raise her hand. One who I know is already beyond the first step doesn't raise her hand either, but nearly half of them do. Fuck bliss, I tell them. Bliss is for children. Bliss is for tourists, for rubes. Do you really think that spiritual enlightenment is going to be like an endless orgasm? This provokes a few muffled titters. A permanent high, heaven on earth, no more problems, no more worries, just sitting around being happy all the time? Doesn't that sound a little, I don't know, sleazy? Like all we're really doing here is trying to cop a great buzz? I pause to let them contemplate it for themselves. Enlightenment isn't a peak experience. It's not an altered state of consciousness. It's not a happily ever after fairy tale. Spiritual enlightenment means waking up, as simple and as difficult as that. Bliss is just the heaven myth repackaged for a slightly hipper crowd. Heaven on earth, heaven here and now. It's really too silly to talk about. But the larger issue here is how such a ridiculous idea got into your heads in the first place. That should be a pretty sobering question. If such a bizarre notion was so firmly rooted in your thinking, what else is in there? If your beliefs aren't your own, whose are they? Who are you? You must re-examine all of your assumptions, and only a small fraction of them are readily visible. Unchallenged beliefs can define you and determine the course of your life. Maybe the whole reason you're on this spiritual track in the first place is due to the unchallenged belief that this path leads to rapture. Maybe you don't really want to go where this really leads. Maybe you're just in it for the fairy tale. I would guess that that's true of over 95% of Western spiritual seekers. I look around and see everyone staring at me wide-eyed. Is my zipper open? Think for yourself. That's the golden rule. Think for yourself. Make it your mantra. Tattoo it on the inside of your eyelids. I perform a theatrical bow. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You've been a wonderful audience. Drive safely. Good night. They applaud on cue and begin talking among themselves, all still a bit energetically buzzed. I plop down into my chair to watch the dying embers. The light drizzle is still falling, and a constant buzz of tiny sizzles can be heard as the moisture meets the heat. I am vaguely aware of a presence somewhere behind me, and assume it's Sarah. "If you're too tired to talk tonight, we can get together tomorrow," I say. "I'm not tired," she replies, as she approaches and sits down on the wet grass beside my chair. She pulls her legs up and wraps her arms around her knees. We watch the fire together in silence for a few minutes before she speaks. "I'm afraid I might be in the wrong place," she begins. "I'm not sure I'm really cut out to learn what you're teaching." "That's certainly possible," I say, wondering if it isn't actually pretty likely. But no, I don't think it's likely at all. This whole thing can come off as awfully one-pointed at times, but the fact of the matter is that the pursuit of truth is in itself a lifestyle choice, and one that can be fulfilling in many ways aside from the actual achievement of the ultimate goal. This is a journey of steps, and every step is, in a very real sense, its own journey. In a way, what we're doing here is an intellectual approach to spiritual development. Do you think you'd be more comfortable with a more heart-centered approach? Of course, what I'm really asking her if she prefers the fairy tale after all. "Maybe," she says weakly. "Maybe," I echo. "But, you know, it's not an earth-shattering decision. It's not something you have to get really hung up on. My guess is that there are some things you're supposed to learn while you're with us. Maybe not everything. Maybe just one or two smaller things. The universe is funny about how it puts us exactly where we need to be to pick up the next piece of the puzzle. I mentioned to you that bit about there not being any winners or losers, right?" "Yes, I remember," she says. "And here you are right now, getting a little panicky, thinking that where you are isn't where you should be. And I agree with you. Maybe you should be moving on soon. Nothing wrong with that. But I doubt that your time here was wasted, or that you don't still have something to pick up while you're here. See what I mean?" She nods to say that she understands, but as someone who spent 3/4 of his life nodding at things he didn't understand at all, I tend to observe nodding heads and muffled assents with a degree of skepticism. "How old are you, Sarah?" I asked. 20, she replies. "Well, let's take an honest look at this. First, you're not going to be crashing through the gateless gate any time soon. Is that something that weighs heavily on you? Do you feel like you have to do well or excel at this spiritual stuff?" "I don't know. Maybe." "Do you think you might be uncomfortable here because you don't feel you're progressing quickly enough?" I was above and somewhat behind her, so all I could make out was the nod, but I could tell she was getting a little emotional about it. I ask how long she's been with us, and she says, "About a week." I laugh. "Well, there comes a point in the journey when it's very appropriate to put a lot of pressure on yourself, maybe even the kind of pressure that can break your mind and land you in an institution." She turns and looks up at me with fear in her eyes. "I wouldn't worry about that just yet," I reassure her. "Do you know what I was doing when I was 20, Sarah?" "You were probably already enlightened and teaching people like me," she answers. Now I really laugh. "Sarah, when I was 20, I was totally lame. A smart, beautiful, spiritually sophisticated girl like you wouldn't have looked at me twice. Little depth, no sense of direction, no acquaintance with spiritual matters, just flailing my way through life. The person that I was at 20 could never have found his way to this house, to this thing we have here, could never have understood it, even in the broadest sense. You're light years more developed and awake than I was then. Now, that doesn't mean you'll be fully awake by the time you're 30, but who knows? Nobody knows anything." Clearly, Sarah only half believes me. "It's true," I affirm. "I didn't start getting interesting until I was nearly 30. Before that, you don't want to know." She's smiling now, a little relieved and a little shocked to hear that someone she had placed on too high a pedestal wasn't really the product of immaculate conception. "You have many years of this spiritual adventure in front of you, probably many lifetimes. Try to take it one step at a time. Even looking 2 steps ahead can be very intimidating. Know what I mean? Breathe more deeply. Drink more water. Meditate more often. Take it easy. You're not struggling to climb from hell into heaven. You're just having an in-the-body experience. It's not evil. It's just life. And when it's over, you die. Easy as falling off a log." Sarah has heard this from me before, but I'm not surprised that she still believes that she's in a bad place and must get to a good one. It's easy to say that there's no race, that there are no winners or losers, but it's a whole different thing to actually get it. This is one of those iceberg deals where it looks fairly small and benign up top, but there's a huge mass of hardened obstruction hidden beneath the surface. I don't think that hearing me spout off on the subject is really going to melt anybody's iceberg. But, like I said from the outset, my role is to sit here and talk about the things I know about, not to get invested in outcomes. Maybe I'm planting seeds. Maybe I'm just inserting subroutines for later execution. Or maybe I'm just babbling in the wilderness. Who knows? Nobody knows anything. Is any of this making any sense? I ask her. Yes, kind of, she says. I think I feel like, I don't know, like something is wrong with me, like I have to keep, I don't know, struggling. Yeah, like nothing is good enough, like I have to become this, like I have to totally cleanse myself, purify myself, and until then I'm, like, I'm not worthy. She sighs. I guess. Like you're an outsider. Not like others. Not valid. She visibly reacts to that. Not valid. So you feel like you're not a valid person. Like you're not real. Not like other people. You must feel terribly out of place almost all the time. Like you don't belong anywhere. Is that how it is? You always feel like you're always outside, looking in? She is nodding and sobbing lightly. And so now you don't feel like you belong here either, because everyone here is in place and you're out of place, so you want to leave. Something releases in her. My whole life is like this, she says through tears and sniffles. I'm always an outsider wherever I go. I never fit in. The crying gets heavier now. Everybody else fits in. I'm not like regular people. I don't know what to do. I let her go on for a minute or two and get herself nice and cried out. No point in talking to her before then. I don't do a lot of personal counseling work like this has turned into. But what the hell? I actually have a soft spot for her problem. Cool, I say after she has calmed down a bit. Very cool. Huh? She asks. What's cool? Why? For two reasons, actually. What? She asks. Everybody is full of shit, Sarah, I say, and let it sit there for a moment before continuing. I don't mean that in a negative way, despite the sound of it. She giggles. I'm just saying that's the deal. It's built in. There's no alternative. Everyone is full of shit. By shit, I mean falseness, false beliefs, false perceptions, and the false personality that's based on them. It's like when you're asleep and dreaming. Your dreams are full of what your waking self would consider falseness, right? Not real? When you wake up, you see them as absurd fictions and wonder how you could have believed they were real while they were happening, right? I guess so. Well, enlightenment is really nothing more than that, waking up from a dream. You, me, here, now, it all seems very real and solid, doesn't it? So much so that the question seems absurd, right? She agrees. But isn't a dream the same way? Isn't it convincing when you're in it? Yes, she says. That's delusion. Exactly the same. This is the dream. The question is, who is doing the dreaming, and how do we wake up? How do we get real? That's what all this enlightenment stuff boils down to. It's about waking up and seeing what's really true. And to do that, we have to become progressively less asleep. We have to fight and scratch and claw our way to wakefulness. In the same sense, if you want to be more true, then the way to do that is by becoming less false, less full of shit. If you want to be less full of shit, then the way to do it is to go inside yourself with the spotlight of discrimination. Find the shit and illuminate it. Illumination destroys it. Lies disappear when you really look at them because they never had any real substance. They were only imagined. That's what you were doing just now, bravely shining a light inward, digging deeper. And that's cool. It's not easy, and it's not fun, but that's the process. That's how the good stuff happens. That's how icebergs get melted back into the ocean. Someone near the fire is playing with burning sticks, and I am reminded of a scene from the Peter Brook and Jean-Claude Carrier adaptation of the Mahabharata. While dancing with burning sticks, Krishna is speaking to Arjuna, who fails to appreciate the absoluteness of the struggle they have embarked upon. To save Arjuna, Krishna has sacrificed a mighty and beloved ally, the magnitude of which Arjuna cannot comprehend. "Yes," says Krishna, "Ghatotkacha has saved you. To preserve your life, I sent him to his death. Tonight, I'm breathing in joy. I was born to destroy the destroyers, and I became your friend out of love for the world." "What's the other reason?" asks Sarah. "Huh? You said very cool, for two reasons." "Oh, because I know exactly what you're talking about. Because I was exactly the same way. And I'll tell you what I wish someone had told me when I was feeling confused and alienated. I wish someone had told me that there wasn't something wrong with me, and that I shouldn't be trying to make it right. That I should stop trying to pound a square peg into a round hole. I wish someone had told me that I wasn't like everyone else, not because I was defective, but because I was designed for other things. Being different might seem like a curse, but the important part is that it's also a blessing. I wish someone had told me to stop trying to fix the curse part and start figuring out the blessing part. Does that make any sense to you?" I guess it does, because she spends the next several minutes with her arms around my neck, releasing what feels like a lot of pent-up tears. When she has spent most of it, and we are able to converse again, her speech is noticeably less constricted, and her laughter seems genuine. As if a belt around her chest had finally been removed, and she was able to breathe freely for the first time in a long while. Cool. Chapter 27. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her, it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. I pass death with the dying, and birth with the new-washed babe, and am not contained between my hat and boots. And peruse manifold objects, no two alike, and every one good. The earth, good, and the stars, good, and their adjuncts, all good. I am not an earth, nor an adjunct of an earth. I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. They do not know how immortal, but I know. Walt Whitman. Chapter 28. Raw Human Things. The universe is the unity of all things. If one recognizes his identity with this unity, then the parts of his body mean no more to him than so much dirt. And death and life, end and beginning, disturb his tranquility no more than the succession of day and night. Zhuang Zi. The next morning, I'm up by 7. I shower and dress in a hurry, grab an apple on my way through the kitchen, and shoot out without anyone seeing me. I stowed my gear in the trunk before going to bed last night, so as soon as I'm in the car, I'm ready to go. I learned from a late-night internet check after the fireside chat last night that today's weather was expected to be picture-perfect, a rare occurrence for April in Iowa. So I made plans to take advantage of it. My skydiving equipment bag was already prepared for the season, so all I had to do was throw some clothes and a towel and a backpack, double-check to make sure I had my logbook and a few other odds and ends, throw it all in the trunk, and make sure the car wasn't blocked in by others so I could make a hasty departure this morning. And that's where I am now, making the 30-minute drive to my home drop zone on a morning that promises to be ideal for jumping out of airplanes. I might be Johnny Enlightened, but I'm not Joe Cool. I always have a nervous stomach on the drive to the airfield that stays with me until I exit the aircraft for the first jump of the day, and today is no exception. It's like a low-level dread. If anything, it's a little worse than usual today, because I haven't done any jumping since December, when I made it down to a drop zone, DZ, in Florida, for a few days. After my first jump, I'm always fine for the rest of the day. It's nice to think that enlightenment lets you transcend emotions like fear at will, but as they say to the beginners in skydiving, if you're not afraid of jumping out of an airplane, there's definitely something wrong with you. Although I don't enjoy the fear, which manifests for me mainly as a grumbly stomach, I actually don't dislike it too much either, since it really has no specific element. I'm not, for instance, particularly worried about injury or death, so the nervousness is pretty much a low-level anxiety that's more in the gut than the heart or mind. Like I said, once you've made that first jump of the day, the anxiety is forgotten until the next time I make the drive. I've made approximately 100 jumps in 5 years, so it's not like I'm a hardcore skydiving enthusiast. I don't take part in relative work, where groups of jumpers create mid-air formations. I don't do canopy relative work, where stacked formations are created under open parachutes. I don't do swooping or any fancy landing stuff that requires high-performance gear. I don't do free-flying or strap a board to my feet or wear a bird suit either, although I'd like to try a bird suit, which would turn me into a human wing and let me transfer much of the vertical energy into horizontal flight. I don't subscribe to the magazines or wear the clothes or go to the skydiving conventions, which are called boogies. Basically, I just like jumping out of an airplane 2.5 miles high and falling toward Earth at 120 miles an hour once in a while. It's like committing suicide, but changing your mind with a few seconds to spare. Just one of those raw human things. I also like getting away from the house and stepping out of the whole spiritual teacher groove for a while. Walking or biking, even by myself, doesn't get me out of it because my mind stays on it, keeps gnawing at the challenge of how to say things better, more clearly. But I can spend an entire day at the drop zone and not think about that stuff at all. Nobody at the DZ identifies me with anything out of the ordinary, like being rural America's contribution to the Illuminati shortlist. They just see me as a 40-year-old guy who likes to jump out of airplanes now and then, which doesn't raise any eyebrows there. I don't totally fit in, but it's an okay place not to totally fit in. I hang out between jumps and talk to other divers and come the closest I ever get anymore to being part of something. I enjoy the drive. I open the windows and turn up the music and try to keep my mind off my nagging stomach. The day is shaping up nicely. Clear, warm days in April that aren't too windy are few. The temperature is in the low 70s, and the wind is less than 10 miles an hour. This is my first time jumping this season. I was at the DZ a month earlier to pick up my rig after having my reserve chute repacked by a licensed rigger, which has to be done every 4 months. But that was March, and nobody was even thinking of going up. When I arrive at the drop zone, there is a refresher course being given to the beginners whose instruction was interrupted by winter. I take a seat in the back, always glad for the opportunity to listen to seasoned jumpers talk about the sport and share their experiences. When the class takes a break, I go up and say hello to the jump master who trained me. We talk about the weather and the new crop of students and the jumping we both managed to get in down south over the winter. It's after 10 o'clock before the plane is fueled and ready for the first run. It's a Cessna Caravan that holds more than a dozen jumpers per load. Manifest, the office where the plane loads are organized, hasn't put me on the first run. I watch as several skydiving virgins are briefed by their jump masters in preparation for tandem jumps. They receive training about how the process will work and what their role in it will be. In tandem jumps, two people use the same parachute. The back of the passenger's harness is attached securely to the front of the tandem master's harness. The chute for tandems is much larger than for singles, and has a drone chute to reduce free-fall speed to what a single diver would experience, 120-some-odd miles an hour, rather than the wicked 200 that the combined weight of two bodies would achieve. People who visit for tandems tend to clog the works at the DZ, but the regular jumpers have to be grateful for the influx of cash they represent, because DZs are marginal businesses, and those who use them regularly want to see them survive. Many of the tandem jumpers come with friends and family, so the crowds can get heavy. Kids running around, lawn chairs, coolers, and video equipment everywhere. People standing with their necks craned back, one hand shielding their eyes, the other pointing skyward. It can be tricky packing a chute on the floor of a hangar when there are kids and dogs running around. Tandems are all scheduled for mornings, so by early to mid-afternoon, everything usually settles down and only the regulars and students remain. I watch as some tandem jumpers receive their instructions and get suited up. They wear jumpsuits, goggles, and sometimes altimeters, although the tandem master will keep track of their height and make sure that the main chute is deployed at the correct altitude. Manifest calls my name for the second run, and I start preparing a few minutes after the first load takes off. I want to be one of the first on the plane, so I can ride it to 14,000 feet or higher before hopping out. It won't be refueling between the first and second loads, so I need to be ready. It's a warm day, so I'm jumping in just shorts, a t-shirt, and strap-on sandals. I slip into my parachute, carefully connecting and adjusting the leg straps, which will support my weight, and the chest strap, which will keep me from spilling out the front. I strap my altimeter to the back of my left hand, drape my goggles around my neck, and approach another ready jumper so we can inspect each other's rigs. When the plane is back and the pilot has set the small portable stairway in place, I wait for a jump master to let me know when to get in. I'd like to be the first in and last out, but if there's an advanced freefall student on this run, then he and his one or two jump masters will be the last out. It turns out that there is an AFF student on this load, and he is only on his second or third level, so he will be diving with two JMs holding on to him all the way from his exit until the time when he deploys his chute at around 5,000 feet. I wait as the student and one of his JMs get in and make their way all the way forward so that they're sitting against the back of the pilot and co-pilot seats. I'm in next, and I position myself in the next most distant position from the door, which is between the student's legs, my back to him, his legs to either side of me, just as mine will be around someone else shortly. I take a moment to confirm that my altimeter is set to zero. Within 2 minutes, it's like a can of sardines in the plane, and we're rolling to one end of the runway in preparation for takeoff. Once we're at the downwind end of the runway and turned around, the pilot locks on the brakes and revs up the engine. The whole plane shudders with the power buildup. Finally, the pilot releases the brakes, and we surge forward. After a few hundred feet, we're in the air, and the airport is shrinking beneath us. Someone passes around a container of breath mints, and I take one and pass them along. Some of the divers are wearing full gear with jumpsuits and helmets with face masks and audible altimeters installed near the ear that will alert them when they have reached preset altitudes. There's a group of four or five near the door that will exit together with their videographer to perform a complex series of relative work formations. There's another videographer on board who I guess is for the advanced freefall student behind me. The videographers wear special helmets with video cameras on the side and 35mm SLR cameras on the top that they control with a hand unit. They are very skilled skydivers. The student between whose legs I am nested is a big guy who is uncomfortable in these tight confines. He's very fidgety. One of the most important things you have to do when you're wearing a rig is guard your handles. Your cutaway handle, your hand-deployed pilot chute or ripcord, and your reserve chute handle. But there's more to be careful about than just the handles, as I'm soon to find out. The entire ride-up is windy because this plane has had its side door removed for the day. Usually the door is left closed for a relatively calm ascent, but the door for this particular aircraft is not ideally suited to being opened and out of the way in flight, so it has been left on the ground near the fuel storage tanks. At around 9,500 feet, the relative workers and their video guy take their positions, some inside and some holding on to handles and standing on foot pegs outside the plane. On a three count, they're away, and the plane surges upward from the abrupt loss of more than half a ton of weight. The next to go is a skyboarder who is having a tricky time negotiating his way around inside the smooth-floored, wind-filled plane with the snowboard-like ski strapped to his feet. He tumbles awkwardly out the door, and another jumper nearby sticks his head out to confirm that the skyboarder managed a safe exit. He gives a thumbs up, indicating to the rest of us that all is well. Behind me, I'm aware of the jump master and the student practicing hand signals and reciting dive flow one last time as the plane banks and heads for higher sky. Everything is going smoothly, and I'm just plain happy, looking at the window, checking my altimeter, basking in the anticipation of falling through the sky 2.5 miles above the world. Then all hell breaks loose. At first, I have no idea what's going on, except that I'm being assaulted from behind. It turns out that the student is actually on his first jump and has just erupted into a full-blown panic attack, flailing and scrabbling and releasing a shrill keening sound that I associate with grieving Arab women. The JM who was sitting beside the student is acting to calm and restrain him, and I've been pushed forward and somewhat onto my side by all the activity. I'm aware of 5 or 6 jumpers watching the whole melee, including the student's second JM and his videographer, and I'm aware that time has slowed markedly so that a piece of cellophane swirling in the wind vortex inside the plane holds my attention for what seems like several minutes. Then things get really interesting. As I'm trying to get myself up into a sitting position on the smooth surface of the floor, I hear the JM behind me call out, "Open container!" The outer pack that's attached to the harness, and which contains the main and reserve parachutes, is called the container. The fact that one is open inside an airborne plane with an open door is a serious piece of news, and it takes me a moment to realize that it's my container he's talking about. That's as long as it takes for the second JM to come to the same realization. He was up on his knees in front of me, and now he scurries on hands and knees around me to get access to my back. I have no idea what the status of my parachute is, but I have certainly read enough incident reports to know what can happen if a rig opens inside an aircraft with an open door. My mind races through the scenarios I have read and allows me, in an instant, to envision the true potential of this situation. If the back of my rig comes open, then my tightly compressed, spring-loaded pilot chute will burst out of the container exactly as it was designed to do, and bite into the wind, which is swirling chaotically through the fuselage. There will probably be a delay of about a second as the pilot chute burbles inside the plane before it finds its way out the open door. And that's when things really start to fly, literally beginning with me. As soon as the pilot chute goes out the door, my death will be certain, and the only question will be whether or not the other passengers and the plane itself make it back safely to Earth. With my pilot chute sucked out of the plane, my main chute will follow instantly behind it, which is exactly how it's supposed to work. Obviously, once my main chute opens and heads out the door, there will be no hope for me. I will be sucked violently out of the plane. Anyone between me and the door, when that happens, will go too, as will a section of the fuselage aft of the door that my body will go through rather than around. A big guy like me might take out a section of a plane's tail assembly as well. In short, grim. My mind courses through this entire scenario in about a millisecond, even as the second JM is still scrambling to get control of the back of my rig. I am back on my side now, completely passive, viewing events with detached equanimity. Joy surges through every fiber of my being. I am embarrassed to be this happy in these circumstances, but I can't help it. I am in the hands of fate, and half a second away from a truly spectacular death. I see the eyes of the other jumpers as they huddle away from the door and out of the path they know I might soon be taking. They watch us, and I see their perplexity as they see my elation. They probably think that I'm nuts. They may even believe that the whole incident is my fault. I don't care. I'm so alive with the thrill of the moment that I'm surprised that the onlookers don't all break into grins of their own just from their proximity to me. After a few moments, I hear the JMs talking. Mine is hugging me from behind, his arms around my chest, using his body to hold my container closed rather than trying to redo whatever has come undone. The other JM seems to have the student calmed down. I knew that if there had been a door on the plane, we would have simply closed it and made a hasty landing. But without a door, the situation is different. The primary jump master orders all jumpers to jump, including the student's videographer. The student, the two jump masters, the pilot, and myself will all land with the plane. The situation is explained to the pilot, and everyone who can jump waits for an adequate spot to deplane, and away they go, abandoning an imperiled aircraft for the safer ones on their backs. The pilot, knowing that there is an unsecured rig on board, begins a steep descent, not wanting to risk catastrophe any longer than necessary. I have never landed in a small aircraft before, and am enjoying the ride down with its steep descent and tight banking turns. Going up was never this much fun. At around 2,000 feet, a thought occurs to me, and I say to the JM hugging me from behind, "What about the AADs?" I can't see the look that passes between them, but both JMs yell, "Pull up!" at the same time. The pilot, not knowing the reason for the orders, reacts abruptly and sends me sprawling free of the JM holding on to me. I expect my container to burst open and prepare for a last-second expression of gratitude. But it doesn't, and I immediately press my back up against the wall of the plane. Although it is impossible to get a secure purchase on the slippery floor, and there is nothing to grab onto. The JM gets on his knees beside me, slips a hand in between the fuselage and me, yells that he has it, whatever it is. AAD stands for Automatic Activation Device. Not everyone has one, but I wear a former student rig, so I do, and I know the student does, and, as it turns out, one of the jump masters does too. The AAD has a built-in altimeter and will automatically deploy the parachute at 1,000 feet if it isn't already out. Normally, it would be safe to have AADs turned on in a descending plane because they only activate over a certain rate of descent, which a descending plane doesn't normally reach. But because we're going down faster than usual, the risk of one or more of them deploying was very real. I know the cases where AADs have saved lives. If someone loses consciousness, or for any reason can't deploy their own chute, then the AAD will pop it for them. They still might have a hell of a landing, but not as bad as it could be. I also know of AAD failures and tragedies, including in-plane deployments. Not pretty. The primary JM, not the one with his hand holding my container closed, gives instructions to the pilot and makes sure the student is calm. He then gets up on his knees and turns off the student's AAD, which is accessed from the top of the rig. He crawls to me, turns mine off, and then stoops forward so I can turn his off without having to move away from the wall. Once the AADs are all off, we're able to land without further incident. When the plane has come to a complete stop, the JM, with his hand on my back, rolls me forward and secures my rig before letting me out of the plane. It would truly suck to go through all that and then have my rig pop open on the tarmac and pull me into a spinning propeller. I don't know if that can really happen, but I am in too good a mood to find out. No one on the ground knows there has been an incident yet, because the skydivers who jumped are only starting to land now, and they're a bit off target because they didn't wait for a perfect spot from which to jump. Of course, people on the ground quickly figure out that something is wrong when a plane lands with 4 skydivers still aboard. I get out of the plane and walk off into the grass, away from the plane and away from the approaching people. I don't want to talk. I don't want to spoil this wonderful moment. I could be involved in the sport of skydiving for an entire lifetime and never again have such an intense, hyper-alert experience. I'm still soaking in the wonder of it and don't want to waste this time yapping about it. I drop my rig and step out of it and stretch out my arms and let waves of gratitude flow through me. What a wonderful fucking world. What a wonderful fucking life. I stash my rig, which will have to be repacked anyway, and head off for a walk. I duck into some nearby woods and find a path and just amble along, replaying the experience and relishing the exhilaration. Half an hour later, I return to the main hangar and realize that everyone thinks I went off to be alone because I was so shaken by the experience. The whole thing is already well on its way to achieving the status of local legend, and my fellow jumpers quickly realize that I'm cool with it and happy to discuss it. I end up telling it half a dozen times that afternoon. A great additional benefit of the whole thing is that the DZ owner is so apologetic that he makes sure that I am scheduled to make every second jump run for the rest of the day. By the time dusk sets in and the plane is rolled back into the hangar, I have gone up 6 times and come down under Canopy 5, the most jumps I've ever made in a single day. And, not realizing that I would have gladly paid extra for a day like this, they don't charge me a dime. All drop zones, in my experience, have fire pits. For a second night in a row, I find myself staring happily into the flames, this time with an entirely different group of people and in an entirely different role. I drink light beer, smoke cheap cigars, and listen raptly to high-flying tales of adventure and bravery and tragedy. This is a special breed of people, and I'm honored to sit among them. Okay, that was fun. Now, back to the Enlightenment stuff. Chapter 29. Layers. Concepts can at best only serve to negate one another, as one thorn is used to remove another, and then be thrown away. Words and language deal only with concepts and cannot approach reality. Ramesh S. Valkskar. I get home after 8 o'clock and go straight upstairs to spend half an hour relaxing in the tub. Skydiving may not seem like a very physically demanding sport, especially since only 20 minutes out of the whole day was actually spent in free fall or under canopy. But by the end of the day at the DZ, I feel as if I've spent 8 hours digging ditches. Constant low-level tension, heat and sun, uncomfortable kneeling when repacking the chute, cramped 15 or 20-minute climbs in the plane, the abrupt deceleration when the chute anchors itself into the air, and the less than gentle landings can all contribute. The tub is a whirlpool, and there's a stereo in the bathroom, so I'm able to listen to relaxing music while I luxuriate in the hot water with the pounding jets. After a while, I turn the jets down, but leave the recirculating heater on and drift off for as sweet a nap as was ever had. When I come downstairs, I find that a late dinner is just wrapping up, so I commandeer the kitchen, close the doors, and begin the cleanup. I have almost nothing but good things to say about Sonea, but damn, that woman can trash a kitchen. She only does the cooking, never the cleaning afterward, so she's not motivated to minimize the mess. Chris comes in carrying a load of plates and glassware. Chris is okay in small doses. He tends to be very fixed in his opinions, so there's really no point in trying to teach him anything until he's able to clear out some room in his head. His teacup is full, in the Zen sense. No room for anything else. That doesn't stop me from teaching him, though. It's not my job to figure out where the words go once they leave my mouth. I'm sure Chris knows exactly why he's here with us, and I'm sure he's wrong. But he'll get what he came for, despite not knowing what it is. And eventually, he'll leave with it, though he'll be disappointed because he didn't get what he thought he came for. This is not terribly uncommon. I don't know why Chris is here, and I'm not all that interested. I don't think about anyone's reasons, real or imagined. That's not my job. My job is to speak, to transmit, to say what I know. Reception is out of my hands. I have no interest in the results because I already know the results. I'm enlightened. I know how it all turns out. Chris has his hand firmly on the tiller of his life. He's in control. He's making the decisions, and he's determining his own fate. Captain of his own destiny may be how he thinks of it, his own man. If I were some revered master in Japan, Chris is one of those guys who would slave in the kitchen for 10 years without ever speaking with me. If I had taught with results in mind, Chris would never be allowed to open a book or converse on spiritual matters until we pried his hands off the tiller. Rigid ego can scuttle the ship before it gets clear of the harbor. I've watched much smarter people than myself, much braver people than myself, break their ships fatally on the rocks because they were too full of themselves to release control. This stuff isn't about brains and balls. It's about desire and flow and purity of intent. "Hey," says Chris, like we're pals, "can I ask you something?"
"Nope."
"Excuse me?" "I like to do the dishes alone, Chris. Find me afterward, and we can discuss whatever you want."
"Oh, okay. Hey, that's cool."
I continue with the cleaning. When I bought the house, it had a perfectly good dishwasher, which I immediately took to the dump and replaced with additional counter and cupboard space. I don't have strong anti-technology feelings by any means, just an aversion to dishwashers. Cleaning a kitchen seems like one of life's little pleasures, and yes, I thought so back in the days before I had an army of little elves keeping the place tidy. Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh says that there are two ways to wash the dishes. The first is to wash the dishes in order to have clean dishes. The other is to wash the dishes in order to wash the dishes. I do it in order to wash the dishes. But since I spend maybe an hour a week in this attempt at mindfulness, I figure it's best not to make myself out as being a real, in-the-moment kind of guy. Many very bright people seem to agree that there's a great deal to be said for mindful action. But except for an occasional stint at the kitchen sink, I'm not one of them. Nor do I think of myself as one of those simple people who takes pleasure in the little things. In fact, if I can get back upstairs before Chris or anyone else snags me for some conversation, then I'll be spending the rest of my evening with Laura Croft battling our way together through perilous Himalayan monasteries in search of the dagger of Zane. But will I make it upstairs before a student corners me? Not likely. As I continue cleaning, I'm amused to imagine a Tomb Raider-like game wherein a harried spiritual teacher has to battle his way through a maze of clamoring students in his bid to get to his well-appointed home theater room. Instead of weapons, however, the students would hurl questions of a spiritual nature at the beleaguered teacher, who must answer correctly in order to make progress. The game would be a sort of 21st-century version of the old Japanese Dharma dueling, where enlightened guys would get into contests to see who could talk the talk better. Why did they do that, one might ask? Well, why not? Why am I teaching and writing a book? Just because. Gotta do something. If they still had Dharma dueling, I'd be happy to represent Iowa in my conference. Well, I'd at least subscribe to a newspaper and follow it in the spiritual sports pages. I digress. That's where my mind really goes when I wash the dishes. Not no mind, monkey mind. If I were one of those revered Japanese masters, I'd probably make myself slave in the kitchen for 10 years without ever speaking to me. I finish the kitchen and make my way upstairs. I get the PlayStation going and advance the game to the point where I left off last time. I am reminded that where I left off last time was at the beginning of a very tricky set of wall climbs and backward leaps that demand mid-air turns followed by grabbing an opposing wall. Failure, of course, results in a long fall and impalement on sharp sticks, which are, for good measure, set in a pool of bubbling lava. The trick is that there is no trick. You just have to do it 50 times and get killed 49. It can get a little frustrating. I know what you're thinking. You think that I'm bringing Lara Croft and the Tomb Raider game into this book as a method of introducing another analogy. You think I'm going to say that a soul develops through many lifetimes on Earth in the same way that in Tomb Raider one develops one's game character through all the increasingly difficult challenges throughout the course of the entire game. I don't blame you for thinking that. It's actually pretty suitable. I mean, here's the character in the game, Lara. Unbeknownst to her, she is being controlled and animated by unseen forces. See? There's a nice higher self, lower self thing going there. Lara faces a series of challenges, each one of which she must master before moving on. And yes, she may die and be reborn many, many times in the course of mastering even one of these challenges before moving on to the next. As the controlling entity or higher self of Lara becomes more adept, the challenges become more difficult, eventually culminating in the final challenge, battling and slaying the ultra-mega-badass dragon, after which the game is complete and no further births are required. You could even take such an analogy further by pointing out that the oversoul in this teaming is always confronted by a specific goal, and whether the game character is swimming blissfully towards that goal in cool blue waters, or whether she's up to her eyeballs in a sizzling pool of lava, is a matter of complete indifference to the higher entity. All that matters is that she's progressing. Yes, I can certainly see why you might think that that's why I'm mentioning my game, but you're forgetting something. This book isn't about the evolution of the soul or the relationship between higher and lower self. It's about abiding non-dual awareness, spiritual enlightenment. And the reason I mentioned playing the game is because, after washing the dishes and tidying up the kitchen, that's what I go upstairs to do. Chris comes in and takes the adjacent seat and, with not the slightest hint of compassion for my female heroine's plight, begins to lecture me on the nature of illusion and the horrors perpetrated by the demonic ego. I finally figure out the trick to the second backward jump twist grab, as Chris sits next to me, using his hands to help him express his insights into the whole big soul, little soul thing. "It's like we're divine beings," he informs me, "like gods, but we're enshrouded in darkness so that we're not awake to our true heritage. It's like a homeless person living on the streets in total destitution, not knowing that he is the son of a billionaire and heir to a massive fortune." Chris is speaking passionately now, as if empowered by his own dismay. One hears conspiracy buffs speak in similar tones, puffy with self-importance and smug in the belief that they have penetrated more deeply than the common run, the herd, into the hidden realms. Running apart from the herd is certainly better than running with it, I could tell Chris, but of no substantive difference if you're still running in the same direction. I'm not too put off by Chris's rant on the nature of delusion, or the fact that he presumes to educate me on this issue. Communicating is a powerful key to understanding, whether it's by oral expression or written. The mind naturally aligns itself into a more coherent state when it seeks to transmit knowledge than when it is merely processing and storing it for its own needs. Lara gets to the top of the wall and has to pull herself up. The top of the wall is sloped, though, so she falls off before I can make her grab again. She plummets and lands on another slope that she slides down. This time I grab the lip when she goes over. I have her pull herself up, but I don't know what to do with her next. I try a backward jump twist grab thing, and she dies a gruesome death. "I mean," Chris continues, "just look at it. Ego. It's all ego. Everyone is imprisoned in a darkness of their own design. God hasn't abandoned us. We've abandoned him.
That's the great irony of it all. Of all the suffering, of all the human misery, it's all so unnecessary. It's all self-inflicted. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi says, "Go and tell the world no one has the right to suffer anymore." And this is exactly what he means. Wake up. That's all you have to do. Wake up and all the pain and suffering instantly disappears.
There's a major Maharishi enclave about an hour south of us here in Unlikely, Iowa, complete with university and a meditating community, not all of whom, judging from the ones who make it to us, are entirely enamored of the TM movement. I suspect that Chris hasn't been authorized to deliver and translate the Maharishi's teachings, and I briefly wonder how he might take something I might say and repackage it for someone else's benefit. "So," I ask as the new Laura begins the climb, "you see enlightenment as a sort of emancipation from the bonds of ignorance, a freedom from ego?" This is Chris's big thing. Make that big thing. Bondage, delusion, ego, all that. He's had other big things in the past, and he'll have more in the future. There are all sorts of big things to have, but they're never the final destination they may at first seem. They're more like island stopovers on a perilous ocean journey. But as they must, all such islands disappear beneath the rising sea, and the journey, perforce, resumes.
End of Disc 6.